Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and the political crisis over the disputed presidential election in Afghanistan is coming to a head. Today, the UN-backed fraud investigation panel threw out hundreds of thousands of votes cast for President Hamid Karzai back in August. That drops Karzai below 50%, the margin he needed to avoid a runoff against his main challenger, the country's former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah. Karzai says he won fair and square and is threatened to block a second election. But today's news comes as the Obama administration signaled strongly over the weekend that it won't send more troops to Afghanistan until the election is settled. Adam Minot is the BBC's World Affairs correspondent. He joins us from London to sort through this all. Adam, to that question, given Karzai's opposition to a runoff, he's said to be furious about the idea. Is there a sense that it has to happen given this new report from the UN-backed fraud panel today?
There certainly is a sense of that, and the message that President Karzai has been delivered by many in the international community that he's got to follow electoral law and go through to a second round vote, which is mandated under the Afghan electoral laws. So, as you say, the Electoral Complaints Commission has been looking at the results of that election taken back at the end of August and found, we're told, that President Karzai has ended up with fewer than the 50% of votes he needed to automatically go through. So a runoff against the man who was placed in second place, that's Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, a former Afghan foreign minister, is mandated now. So that's certainly what we're expecting. But whether we get there or not, I think remains open because, as you indicated, there is a lot of opposition from within the administration in Afghanistan.
Well, but doesn't Karzai have his own commission that's also looking into the election, and they're said to be the supreme authority?
You're absolutely right, and there are two bodies looking at this. The Complaints Commission, their job is to look at the faulty or suspected faulty voting records, and I've got their list in front of me. I mean, to give you an example of one of the polling stations where they found errors, this one, they said there were 100% uniform markings, i.e. all the ballot papers were marked in the same way, 100% of the ballots were never folded, and they're all marked with the same felt tip marker. So, I mean, that's an indication of the level of fraud and corruption that took place. Yeah. But you're absolutely right, there is an independent electoral commission. The appointees to that are made by President Karzai, and it is their job to announce the election result. And we've been getting messages from the Afghan capital, Kabul, during the course of the past few days that they don't like the decision that's been made by the Complaints Commission, and they're going to be very reluctant to sign off this new score in the election. But as I say, there is massive international pressure being applied to the Afghan administration, not least by the United States, which, as you said, is sitting on a decision to send an additional 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. But President Obama has said he won't do that until the electoral position is clear.
Well, how do we read those comments from Obama officials, but also Obama administration officials, but also from Senator John Kerry in Kabul over the weekend, saying things like Afghanistan doesn't have a credible government right now. There is no ally. So how can we be supporting an ally when there's no official ally, and indicating that that stands in the way of sending more troops? Is this the White House using the threat of withholding troops as leverage to get Karzai to act and have the runoff election? Or is this the White House using the Afghan presidential election as an excuse not to send troops? Because even if a new election is called, it'll take months to carry it out. And that would seem to just push this controversial question of more troops down the road, which politically some would say the Obama administration might embrace. So how do you read this?
Yeah, I think there are at least those two ways you indicate of reading this. I think, first of all, there is genuine concern that if there isn't a coherent administration legally elected, then the international community, headed, of course, by the United States, which has most troops operating in the country, is going to be very reluctant to commit more troops when things politically are so uncertain. But I think you're undoubtedly right as well by indicating that this is being used as a bit of a lever on the administration and a very straightforward lever. If you don't fall in line with this electoral result, then we're not going to send troops. I mean, that's a very stark message that's being sent there. So I think there's a lot, obviously, going on behind the scenes. Certainly Ambassador Khalilzad, the United States representative, he's been in and out of President Karzai's office and indeed the office of the main second contender, Dr. Abdullah, pressing both men to try to find some sort of compromise. And it has been suggested that maybe a way out of this is to have some sort of interim administration calling on the expertise of all the principal presidential candidates, but that would, in a sense, fly in the face of international of Afghan electoral law, which says there should be a runoff. And you talked about the timetable there in your question, Robin. And really, according to the law, this runoff must take place within a fortnight. So time is pressing. Now, I'm told that the ballot papers have already been printed. But really, the electoral authorities in Afghanistan are up against the weather because the snow has started to fall high on the mountains, cutting off some areas already, and that position is only going to get worse as the days go on. So a large section of the electorate simply is going to be ruled out from getting anywhere near a polling station.
Yeah, because when we understand when those snows occur, which will happen in just a few weeks, and the high mountain passes, it's impossible to organize and conduct an election. And also people will again be sitting ducks for the Taliban. Adam Minot, the BBC's World Affairs correspondent, talking about the sticky situation in Afghanistan as a UN report finds fraud in the presidential election. Adam, thanks so much.
Robin, thank you.
Well, the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan right now is based on counterinsurgency, fighting insurgents, but also countering their power over people by building relationships with civilians, helping them rebuild their country, which is what a group of farmers from the Midwest is trying to do in Afghanistan. They're working with Afghan farmers and their livestock. The sounds of an Afghan livestock market in Khost province in eastern Afghanistan, where Army National Guard agribusiness development teams have been deployed. These are American farmers with degrees in agribusiness, animal husbandry, and engineering. But unlike NGOs, non-governmental organizations, they are also soldiers with guns, and they are targets.
So just as we move forward, the whole front end of the truck lifted. Debris was flying up. I had a window directly across from me. And when it hit, and the first thing in my mind was, were we all right?
That was Sergeant Major Robert Lee Gooden of the Indiana National Guard's 119th Agribusiness Development Team, describing an IED attack on his convoy. Everyone survived, but some soldiers suffered from concussions that could cause brain trauma. Independent journalist Doug Wissing spent a month in Afghanistan with the 119th and reported on it for Indiana Public Radio. He joins us now with what he found. Doug, welcome.
Nice to be here, Robin.
Just remind us why these agribusiness development teams, as we're hearing, it's very dangerous. You'd think that security would be number one. So why an agribusiness development team?
Well, the theory is we have to engage with the population to begin to quell the insurgency. And these are areas where it's too kinetic, it's too violent for standard NGOs to go in and do development work. Now, that's a source of some conflict within the NGO and the military mm-hmm. communities.
Well, you go to a marketplace, and here we're going to hear Colonel Brian Copes, commander of the 119th, being the farmer soldier that he is, both talking about farming, but then being a soldier. Let's listen.
How much for the shelled walnuts?
This is 150, this is 500.
500?
Yeah.
Will he sell me half a kilo?
Gotta go. An Indiana farmer soldier negotiating a purchase of nuts in an Afghan marketplace, but within minutes, his squad sounds a siren and he's gotta go. Doug Wissing, is that pretty much the pulse of the work?
Yeah, absolutely. For instance, to go to that market research trip was an incredibly tense mission. There were lots of IEDs in that market, assassination attempts. The security team had determined that we had literally 7 minutes to dismount from MRAPs, these vast armored vehicles that everyone travels in now to protect themselves from IEDs. And there's gunners on top with machine guns and automatic grenade launchers. You're surrounded by a perimeter of security soldiers. Everyone's dressed in full body armor and helmets, and you walk over and negotiate for tomatoes and nuts, and you have 7 minutes to get it done, and because they figure the Taliban can't organize an attack in 7 minutes.
And by the way, why even negotiate for tomatoes and nuts? What was the importance to the team of that?
Firstly, to determine what's the price. What is the price for tomatoes or the price for shelled walnuts? For instance, I think in this particular case, walnuts were a potential cash crop that they could help nurture in host province. And some of them came from further north of host. So they were trying to determine what is the cost. A lot of goods come from neighboring Pakistan. So what's the cost and what's the cost of production? And is this a cash crop that they could help nurture to help farmers increase their incomes incrementally?
But then the siren goes off. Time's up.
It's time to get back in the truck. And I think about the best summary I can come up with is it's a really difficult mission in a really complicated place.
And just tick off, what are some of the other things the ADT teams are trying to do agriculturally?
They're involved with animal husbandry projects. And in general, they're really focused on training, helping the Afghan ag extension agents go out into the field and teach people how to trim hooves, for instance, or to increase better inoculations and vaccines. They're involved with small-scale irrigation projects up in the villages in the mountains where they slow the water down through the construction of small rock dams that the villagers help construct so they get some income and they get something that they can maintain themselves as opposed to a really large capital project.
Well, as you say, part of the job is to counter the power of the insurgency. And again, here's Colonel Brian Copes of the Indiana National Guard on what he tells Afghans that he worked with.
What I say is knowledge is something that the Taliban cannot take away and will last long after the coalition forces have gone home and our money has run out. Knowledge is something that the Taliban cannot blow up or burn down.
Doug, host province borders Pakistan. It's under the control of Pashtun warlords. It's known for the insurgence attacks that we've been saying. Just last month, a suicide bomber rammed a car into a military convoy. Staff Sergeant Alex French, the 4th of Georgia, was killed. Clearly dangerous. Just a little bit more about the situation there.
There are some regions that are pretty much Taliban-controlled. It's a traditional place to resist infidels. It was the first place, host province, that basically threw the Soviets out during that war. The Pashtuns have a 1,000-year-old warrior culture. They've been doing this for a long time, and we're the latest infidels.
Well, and we've been bouncing back and forth between the agricultural work that the troops do there and the soldiering that they do there, because that's what the life is like. And I just want to go back to the soldiering for a second, because you traveled with them in these heavily armored vehicles, the MRAPs, which were built to try to resist these roadside bombs. And one bomb went off ahead of you in your convoy. Fortunately, no one was killed. But here's some radio chatter. Now everybody's on the alert looking for another tripwire, and someone thinks they have it. Let's listen.
Hey, I got a secondary tripwire up here.
Good catch, 2-2. We'll call it up.
And again, that radio call helped members of the ADT team avoid a second roadside bomb. Someone spotted the sun glinting on a tripwire. Farmers indeed, they're soldiers as well. We're talking with Doug Wissing, an independent journalist who embedded with the Indiana National Guard's 119th Agribusiness Development Team in host province Afghanistan. While the south of Afghanistan is notorious for poppy fields, a cash crop that fuels the drug trade and funds the Taliban, farmers in host province mainly raise wheat, and the American farmer soldiers we've been hearing about are trying to help them. We're going to hear more from Doug Wissing when we come back. Later today, what are medical homes and why might they provide better medical care? That's later, but back in a minute with Doug Wissing, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with independent journalist Doug Wissing. He spent a month this summer embedded with the Indiana National Guard's 119th, that's the Agribusiness Development Team, working in host province along the border with Pakistan in Afghanistan. And Doug, before the break, we talked about the dangers these soldier farmers face as they try to build some goodwill with people by working with Afghan farmers. But these ADTs, as they're called, the Agribusiness Development Teams, are also doing damage control. You went with Deputy Commander Colonel Sindra Chastain to the village of Alidaya. She met with farmers there ostensibly to talk about some problems they were having with bad seeds. But there's a huge backstory here because Al-Idiyah was the site of one of the worst civilian casualties in the war. Tell us about that.
Our mission to Al-Idiyah came after a really tragic situation where an Afghan army colonel's family, which included a four-day-old baby, was mistakenly killed by special ops teams who were chasing some Taliban. A mother was killed who was an Afghan teacher for girls in that village, which is an incredible rarity. We speak of building girls' schools all over Afghanistan, and a good number stand empty because there are no teachers for girls. So this was a multiple tragedy. The ADT was attempting, the term that Colonel Chastain kept using was, we're going to go show them some love. And it was an effort by all of the military to try and make amends for this thing that had happened. Now, I think that's really commendable. But we have to understand the issue of civilian casualties in Afghanistan is something that can lose us this war pretty easily. Even though the Taliban killed the majority of civilians, we're held to a much higher standard, and this is a major issue.
Well, and it can't help with the tension between the military and NGOs, the non-governmental agencies. You spoke with Jamie Terzi of CARE.
Coalition forces go and make a mistake in a raid, kill one of our teachers, her daughter who was a student, and three of her family members, including a four-day-old baby, inside her house, which was one of our classes. I find it really personally hard to understand how a four-day-old baby is shot. Did you not look when you were firing? Because, you know, if it was for any other reason but a four-day-old baby.
Jamie Terzi of CARE. Doug Wissing, that's how she felt about a mistake on the part of special ops. How does she feel about these military hybrids we've been talking about, the ADTs or agribusiness development teams? They're both soldiers and farmers doing the work of NGOs.
There is a real tension between the NGO community in Afghanistan and the military over this issue. That is changing a little bit over time as the military is making an effort to bond the NGOs into some of their projects. The NGOs contend that the military create problems for the NGOs because then the Afghan insurgents can't make distinctions between the military and the NGOs. And I think there's some validity in that. The military responds that they're doing work where it's too violent for NGOs to do much work, and there's some validity in that. Where that balance is, I'm not really certain.
What do you think about the work of the 119th? You worked alongside them. Sometimes it's hard to be critical when bonds are forged in the field. But do you think that their work is bearing fruit or will bear fruit?
I saw a wonderful RAND study by Seth Jones where he analyzed 90 post-World War II counterinsurgencies. And the average length of time it took to defeat and establish an insurgency is 14 years. The Indiana National Guard has made a 5-year commitment to having agribusiness development teams in host province, which is a really long commitment. So first, I liked the thought they had a long timeline. Secondly, I liked that they were trying to deal with Afghan-appropriate projects that were developed in partnership with the farmers of host province. And they seemed to be sustainable projects. They were low-dollar projects, those kinds of things. So there's that. And then the second thing is this team, the first of this is the first team, they understand they aren't going to see the fruits of their labor. They are literally making the connections. They're literally finding out where is that village. They're literally saying this would be a good place for a check dam. So if we think in a long time frame, 15 years, 3 generations, something like that, yes, I think there's some real potential. If we talk about it in terms of the next American election cycle, the next 12 to 18 months, no, it's ridiculous. We won't see anything. We'll see small things. Maybe we'll see the beginning of trust. Let's not forget that the Afghans have seen us come and go quite a bit. They're pretty jaded. We make a lot of promises that we don't keep. So you can clearly see trust building between Afghan villagers and these soldiers. You know, you can just see the interpersonal relations between them. But we have to maintain a longer commitment than the next cycle of strategy.
I'm just thinking, you said the RAND study showed counterinsurgency strategies take 14 years. We're 8 years into the war in Afghanistan. That would leave about 6 more.
I don't think we can think about it that way, unfortunately. We're really talking about reignition of the insurgency that probably started about 2005, 2006. And we initially tried to deal with that with conventional warfare and really alienated the population. We've only switched to a counterinsurgency strategy relatively recently. And now that's moving down through the ranks. You see commanders and soldiers, and, you know, there's been a real acceptance, it appears to me, in among the military that counterinsurgency is the correct strategy as opposed to conventional warfare. So now I don't think we can say, oh, we're 8 years in, we've only got 6 years left. I wish I could say that.
That's Doug Wissing, an independent journalist who spent a month this summer with the Indiana National Guard's 119th Agribusiness Development Team. And he's going to return to Afghanistan in November to see if he can follow the money trail, find out what happened to the estimated $60 billion in U.S. and international development money in Afghanistan. Doug, we hope to speak with you then. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have time for a couple of quick programming notes. Coming up later this week on Here and Now, we'll explore the secret lives of classical composers. Did you know that Wagner was obsessed with women's underwear? And also this week, former venture capitalist Woody Tash taking a page from the slow food movement, calling for slow money. He says, invest in local businesses and farms. Watch your money grow a little slower. Why accept the Wall Street status quo?
Everything that we're dealing with right now in finance, in agriculture, in food, it's all related, has all happened in the last 50 to 75 years. It just seems crazy that you could do something slower as a solution to all of this speed run amok.
Woody Tash on Slow Money later this week.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A Massachusetts high school is hoping to crack down on student drinking by bringing in breathalyzers. Other states use breathalyzers at events. Kansas is a state that uses breathalyzers during the school day. But Foxborough High School will be the first in Massachusetts to try them if the school board signs off on their plan tonight. School officials said they made the decision after 12 incidents of underage drinking last year. Jeffrey Theodos is the principal at Foxborough High School. Principal Theodos, I know you think that these breathalyzers will be used primarily at school events, but what happens if a teacher thinks a student's been drinking and it's during class?
We're going to use our normal policies. We'll bring the student down, have a conversation with them, talk to them, and then assess, like we always do and have done in the past, whether we think that there's been use of alcohol. And again, to keep it as clean as possible and give the student the chance to be able to say that they are innocent, we would administer the breathalyzer. So I don't anticipate using it very, very often, nor do I anticipate using it on a student multiple times.
Are you worried about liability? Are you worried about invasion of privacy issues? Because when breathalyzers are used with adults, they do have the right to refuse. I mean, it varies state to state, but when adults are driving and they're stopped, they have the right to refuse. Now, there might be a consequence or a suspicion if they refuse. But will kids have that same right?
I guess that we're treating it the same way as the police would when they stop someone. We're thinking that we're pretty confident when we accuse a student of being involved in alcohol. And when that occurs, we're giving the student an opportunity to say that we're wrong.
But what happens if they don't want to take it?
The same punishments would apply. Well, I guess my argument is, why would you not want to take it?
So what would the punishment be if they don't take it?
It would be a suspension, like, per the handbook policies.
Wow. And what would the punishment be if they have been drinking?
Same thing. It's a 5-day suspension, and it is inability to attend extracurricular activities for 2 weeks. And again, we're trying to make it a school issue and not necessarily a police issue.
Well, and we do understand, too, that you have a much lower threshold. It's going to be a reading of 0.02 would mean a student had been drinking. With adults, it's 0.08.
Right. Well, don't forget, that's under the influence. The school committee policy is, you know,
any drinking
at all. And so we're just trying to be proactive. And I think the other piece is that, you know, kind of Columbine changed the rules of the game. And we spend countless hours developing a policy for the eventuality of any kind of problems that could occur from an emergency situation in the school. And so this is just, again, another step to be proactive, not necessarily to infringe upon students, because, like I said, that's the last tool we would use in the discovery process.
Right. The ACLU has said they think this is a terrible idea because they think it's going to drive students to use drugs instead of alcohol because alcohol is easier to detect, or drink, you know, where they can't be found by the school. Are you worried about that, driving it underground?
I mean, you know what, you always try to stay a step ahead of the students because they'll always find ways to tweak the circumstances and get around situations. So you can only control as many factors as you can. And so we know that drinking and driving is problematic, and we're just trying to be, again, as proactive as we can with another tool that helps us to diagnose that situation.
You know, I'm wondering, Principal Theodos, people across the country might be thinking, Foxborough High School, Foxborough, isn't that the home of the New England Patriots who thrashed Tennessee yesterday in a 59-0 rout in a terrific game? But you are a football town, and you know there's even concerns about adults leaving the game. Does that rub off on the school that you might have a little more issues about drinking just because you're the seat of a big football team?
Yeah, I would say that there's certainly things that spill into the community, not necessarily from people who are in a community, but just people who are going to the events hosted by Foxborough. So I think that our problem is a universal problem. I don't have a sense it's a tremendous problem. And so, again, we just have a tool that allows us to be more proactive.
Right. That's Jeffrey Theodos, principal of Foxborough High School. Principal Theodos, thanks so much again for speaking with us.
Sure. Nice talking with you, Robin.
Of course, some of us think they should breathalyze everyone leaving the game, but that's another story. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Go to hereandnow.org, and you can click on Contact Us to send an email or get a phone number to call. Or you can just scroll down the homepage and leave a comment right there. We'd love to hear from you. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Several states, including Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and California, are pioneering something called medical homes. Now, they're not real homes. It's a concept of keeping medical records all in one place and having one primary care physician manage a team of professionals that may include a nurse practitioner or mental health worker working to execute a single care plan created by the primary care doctor, in part to prevent overlapping care, like one specialist ordering a test that's already been done. North Carolina has adopted this model statewide. Vermont is moving towards that. Congress is considering adopting it nationwide. The Obama administration just announced increased funding for medical homes through Medicare. And it could partly be because groups like Group Health, which runs medical homes in Ohio, published a report claiming greater patient and physician satisfaction, less use of emergency rooms, and lower costs with medical homes. Kenneth Thorpe helped design the program in Vermont. He's also a health policy and management professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University there in Georgia. Kenneth, first of all, tell us more how these medical homes work.
Well, sure. You're a patient, could be a Medicare patient, Blue Cross patient. You would have an ongoing relationship with a primary care provider. That primary care provider would be responsible for leading a team of other providers to make sure that you get the care that you need, whether it's at home, a hospital, in the physician's office. The key is to have somebody in charge for coordinating the care.
Right now, what happens is your doctor might refer you to someone else, and then you go off to that other doctor, and they're not necessarily connected.
No, that's exactly right. So a Medicare patient, for example, may see seven different specialists in four different practices during a year, and none of that care is generally coordinated. So going to different specialists, that specialist may not know what medications you're on, what other problems you may have. So particularly for patients driving healthcare spending in the system, which is chronically ill patients, moving toward a medical home model, I think, is absolutely essential to improving quality and reducing costs.
Well, let's hear from Dr. Joyce Dobberdin. She's a family physician in Lydonville, Vermont, one of the first doctors to be involved in a medical home pilot project in Vermont. She told us about a chronic care coordinator on one of her teams. Let's listen to how this nurse helped an older woman who was having trouble keeping track of her medications.
She was able to sit down with the woman. She developed a color-coded medication list where she could X off whether or not she took them. There was a line about what they were used for. And now the woman She's understanding much more what these medications are for and how to take them.
Well, but Kenneth Thorpe, if you bring in, for instance, a chronic care coordinator helping the physician coordinate, isn't that costing a lot?
We have to recognize that most health plans in the private sector and certainly Medicaid already pay for care management today. And that Vermont example is a great illustration. Those are community health teams of nurses, nurse practitioners, social mental health workers. Everybody shares in the cost of those community health teams. So it turns out to actually be no more expensive than what plans are paying today, and in many cases, less expensive.
Well, wait, when you say everybody shares in the cost, what do you mean by that?
The community health team may have five or six different professionals, and the salaries of that team are paid for by Blue Cross and Cigna and the Medicaid program.
Well, the word salaries is a key, too. I'm just curious because that gets us into the debate of fee versus salary. So you're saying that these people are salaried, they're being paid anyway, as opposed to getting a fee each time they work with a patient?
Exactly right. They don't have to worry about billing, what's covered, what's not covered. That team member gets to go and work with a patient and do the job that they're trained to do.
Well, and Dr. Dobbertin also told us about a patient that she had been telling to lose weight for years. And it wasn't until the medical home team approach started that the person actually lost weight because they had a nutritionist, a community health educator. This patient lost 24 pounds and attributes it to this extra push that she got from this team. But I can just hear someone saying, that's babysitting. We shouldn't be spending money telling people to implement their care plan. How much money do we save because they do?
In general, the estimates are that we could save about 5 to 7% off the cost of health care if we did this nationally. And the best examples I can give is that if you are really working with patients to make sure that they're filling and refilling their prescriptions, keeping their blood sugar under control, we can reduce admission rates to the hospital. We can probably by 50% reduce readmission rates into the hospital as well. So it's just good primary care that just doesn't happen in today's healthcare system.
I'm wondering if the medical homes are better or worse for rural areas. How is a rural physician going to put together a medical home? How are they going to have access to the other members of the team who are specialists?
In the states that have done this, Vermont, North Carolina, the state has put together the teams, and the physicians can or cannot use them. It's up to them. If they do use them, they get a little bit of an additional per member per month payment. But most physician practices find these teams very helpful. They're basically a free extension of their medical practice. They do all the follow-up care with the patients that physicians generally don't have time to do. And they're a big benefit for smaller physician practices that operate in rural areas.
Well, and what does this do for the physicians who are taking on the role of sort of the team leader? How much extra work is this?
It is extra work putting together the care plan. And in Vermont, for every patient in that physician's practice, he or she would receive about $1.50 per person per month in recognition that they're probably going to see fewer patients, a good thing, I think, because it gives the physician now more time to make sure the patients in their practice are improving and not getting worse.
But we don't have enough primary care physicians as it is.
Well, that's a good point, and I think most of the primary care that's delivered in this model is done by nurse practitioners.
Well, and we just want to be clear, these nurses or nurse practitioners and other members of a healthcare team, maybe a dietitian or a nutritionist, might be salary-based, as we said, paid for by insurance companies or states. But under the current system, doctors or personal care physicians are paid by fees. So, say, each time a patient comes into the office, they are paid. But they're not paid an extra fee for aftercare, so they have no financial incentive right now to do it.
That's exactly right. And Medicare is sort of the worst example of this. 95% of what we spend in the Medicare program is linked to patients with multiple chronic conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, and so on. And today, a physician may put together a care plan for that patient. The patient goes home, and there's no follow-up care, largely because the physician practice is busy. And B, Medicare doesn't pay for that follow-up care. So, you know, that's just a major shortcoming in the Medicare program that is being discussed as part of healthcare reform, that is to build these community health teams nationally and provide a mechanism that when that patient does go home, that the care plan is executed, we can keep the patient out of the hospital. And if they're admitted to the hospital, today in the Medicare program, 20% of patients who are admitted to a hospital are readmitted within 30 days. And we can probably cut that in half by using this care coordination medical home approach.
That's Kenneth Thorpe, a professor of health policy and management at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Georgia, also was a health official in the Clinton administration and helped implement the new model of medical care called medical homes in Vermont. Kenneth, thanks for telling us about it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, back in a minute with a Balloon Boy update here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. We start with just a quick news note about the story that's now officially been reduced to Balloon Boy. The lawyer for the parents of Falcon Heaney says he's expecting charges to be filed by Wednesday and that the parents will plead not guilty. Yesterday, the Larimer County, Colorado sheriff announced he'd seek charges after being convinced that the story of the six-year-old floating away in a helium balloon was a hoax/marketing ploy from the parents. To add to their potential legal woes, a website, Gawker.com, is running emails from a colleague of Richard Heaney. The emails, which Gawker paid for, are headlined, "I helped Richard Heaney plan a balloon hoax." That and the fact that his son said on CNN, "We did all of this for a show." During the late 15th and early 16th centuries, Portugal was a major global power, building an empire out of the spice trade. Much of Europe got rare items such as pepper from Portuguese ships, but eventually the Dutch and other traders moved in and Portuguese influence faded from the world stage and from the kitchen. Well, today, outside of immigrant enclaves such as Fall River in Massachusetts, Portuguese cuisine isn't as well known as, say, Spanish or Italian fare. But food author and Fall River native David Leet wants to change that. His cookbook, The New Portuguese Table, not only gives a taste of the classic cuisine of Portugal, but also explores the new vibrant flavors that the country's chefs use to update old favorites. Here now's resident chef Kathy Gunst recently talked to David about the book. They met for lunch at a Tasca, a Portuguese restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a bit of a rarity for David. As he told Kathy, when he was growing up, Portuguese restaurants weren't all that common. That's one of the reasons why he thinks that Portuguese cuisine isn't more well known.
We have a culture of eating at home, of eating grandmother's food or mom's food. We never ate out. So the idea of actually sitting in a restaurant, I didn't eat at a restaurant until I was 11 years old. And it was a Chinese restaurant. Now things have changed. I think people are becoming more familiar with Portugal as they travel there because of all they've heard.
Before we begin to talk about the book, introduce us to the elements that distinguish classic Portuguese cuisine.
Sure. Classic Portuguese cuisine uses a lot of the ingredients that Spanish does, but we use it in different ways. For instance, some of the major ingredients are salt cod and tomatoes, garlic, a lot of onions. Cilantro is big. As a matter of fact, I believe Portugal is... That's one of the biggest distinctions between Portuguese cooking and Spanish cooking is we use more cilantro, far more cilantro. And pork also is very big. And also, of course, the use of seafood. I mean, we have all these miles and miles of coast, and of course the Portuguese were the great navigators of the world. So seafood plays a very, very important role in our food.
When I think of Portuguese cooking, I think of one food, and it's green. And you either love it or you hate it, and that would be kale.
Absolutely. Kale is huge in Portugal. It's called couve galega, which is Galician kale. And it is used in so many dishes, but of course the most famous is caldo verde, which is the called green soup. It's what people have considered the national dish of Portugal, which is kale and potatoes in a broth, and it's pureed. And then the kale is stirred in, so like little whisker-thin pieces of kale, with one and only one piece of chorizo, which is the sausage. Now, my mother always said, not one piece. You put in three or four minimum.
You grew up in Fall River, Massachusetts, which you call America's biggest little Portugal. Food was a big part of your childhood, and yet you weren't necessarily interested in the traditional Portuguese cooking until later in life.
Exactly. Growing up, I always said that I just wanted to be blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and have a last name of Abernathy or something like that. I just did not want to be Portuguese because we lived in a, I guess for lack of a better word, a Portuguese ghetto. Everyone I knew was Portuguese. Every store we went to was Portuguese. And I didn't want to eat all these strange things, all this kale and all these smelly fish. I wanted McDonald's, and there was no McDonald's in Fall River when I was growing up. And it wasn't until my grandmother died, I was 32 years old, that some of the dishes died with her. And I realized that they were gone completely. My heritage was quickly leaving. And my mother had her versions of those dishes, but they just weren't the same because my grandmother had been making them for 60-something years, 70-something years, I guess. And I realized I had to start understanding the food more. So I began learning how to cook my mom's dishes, my aunt's dishes. And I just became so enamored when I went to Portugal for the first time to São Miguel, the island my family's from, and began falling in love with it. It was a slow courtship, I have to admit. It wasn't right at first that I went, oh, this major epiphany. It took a little while.
So now you've written this book, The New Portuguese Table, where you've really introduced us to some very modern, vibrant food. I spent some time in Portugal about 25 years ago, and as I was leafing through the book, there was a lot I didn't recognize.
What's happening is so many things have changed in Portugal. There's been this infusion and influx of ingredients and of chefs from all around the world, and local chefs went and studied in, I know one chef who studied in Pittsburgh, one who studied in New York, one who studied in Sydney, Australia, and they brought back a lot of the things they learned, and of course, Italy. And what's interesting is Portugal turned its back on Europe after the Age of Discovery, when they suddenly lost their empires to the Dutch and to the English and other people. And I think this is kind of the awakening. I always say that in the Age of Discovery, Portugal discovered the world, and now the world's returning the favor because they're all coming to Portugal. And so all these ingredients are being used in different ways or being combined in different ways. And these chefs who've learned and trained across the world are bringing back some interesting techniques and looking at the food differently, but they're not losing their bearing. They're not losing their sense of homeland.
Just wanted to mention a few of these dishes because when you read through these recipes, some of them sound familiar, but they're not recognizable as Portuguese. For instance, white gazpacho with a crab salad. We have a black olive risotto. Yum, yum, and yum. But Portuguese?
Yes. And what it is each one of those are based on something else. The white gazpacho is based on a dish which is called caranguejo no carro, which is crab in a carriage. And what it is, it's a crab meat salad with some chopped vegetables all mixed up and then served in its body. And then you spoon it out. Well, those same basic flavors are in the crab meat salad that's in the gazpacho. The gazpacho is huge in Portugal. This is made with almonds. And, of course, almonds are huge in Portugal. And then the black olive risotto is really an homage to what goes on in Portugal because we have a lot of rice there. Olives are huge in Portugal. And I think it marries the Portuguese with the Italian, and sort of that it shows, I call it the poster child for modern Portuguese cooking because it's an infusion of Italian and Portuguese, and it's showing the Portuguese ingredients being used in a very unusual way.
Up here comes our lunch.
Oh, marvelous. Look at that.
Oh, beautiful.
This is classic, classic Portuguese. Now, what you have, Kathy, is called caldeirada de peixe, which is a fish stew. I believe this one has salmon, monkfish, and hake. Potatoes, a little bit of a tomato broth with parsley on top. And then this is a classic dish. This is porco alentejana, which is from the Alentejo region, which is the big swath in the south. And it's chunks of pork with clams and in a massa de pimentão. It's a pepper sauce, a red pepper, red bell pepper sauce that's salty. And they fry chunks of potatoes and then mix it all together. And it's marvelous.
Pork and clams. It's my family. We call it the most unkosher dish in the world.
It's the most unkosher dish.
Okay, let's eat.
Okay.